This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 7th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up today, we take a tour of one of Oscar Niemeyer's lesser-known buildings in Lebanon, the Tripoli International Fair. And we investigate Tiffany's new CT60 watch collection with Nicola Andreata, Vice President and General Manager at Tiffany & Co. Swiss Watches.
We are trying to tell a story of craftsmanship, and at the same time, we want to reference our history. You know, the fact that we are, first of all, a jeweler, at the same time a watchmaker, means that we have a great attention to details.
Plus, we find out about a new swimming pool that'll allow you to swim in the Hudson River, and we'll meet a Belgian duo creating beautifully innovative furniture. All that coming up here on Section D, our dedicated design show on Monocle 24. We begin with Brazilian architect Oscar Niemeyer, who's best known for his huge body of work in his home country. But he also designed several less famous projects in the Middle East. One of these is the Tripoli International Fair in northern Lebanon, an architectural gem that now lies almost completely abandoned. Vanessa Rainey took a tour to find out more.
Welcome everyone, I'm happy you're here. It's a big space, and it's gonna take around like 2 hours of walking around inside, 2 hours, 2 hours and a half.
So begins Miriam Minkara's tour of the little-known International Fair of Tripoli, a graveyard of sorts for Brazilian architect Oscar Niemeyer's first ever project in the Middle East, one of around 600 he designed globally. Commissioned by the Lebanese government in the early 60s to encourage investment outside of the capital, Beirut, work on the epic 100 square kilometre site continued until 1974, just 1 year before the country was plunged into a 15-year civil war. Occupied by the Syrian army for nearly 2 decades, it quickly fell into disrepair.
So whatever you will see inside, half, like quarter of it is like unfinished, but three quarter of it is finished. But unfortunately, it was never really used, okay? Apart from the Syrian army.
Built almost entirely from concrete and brick, the site is a wonderland for modern architecture enthusiasts. Among the 15 buildings are a distinctive soaring arch marking the entrance to an open-air performance space, an experimental domed theatre, a social housing project, and much more, all nestled within a well-maintained park.
The whole idea was to have constructions in an area like a wild vegetation. So he wanted all the orchids that were here to stay, and then you build all the buildings around it and it would be open. But of course, this had like lots of problem with the architects here because, you know, of course we want to close, you know, because in Brasilia it's all open. Yeah. And in Brazil, everything nearly what he did was open, really.
Public.
So public, exactly. He actually had some arguments with the architects about like the walls. If you see, there are walls around. So he didn't want any walls. He's like a communist. He didn't want any walls. It's all for everyone, you know. But then they find a middle solution, which we will see on our way.
Minkara, a Tripoli local who runs regular tours around both the International Fair and the ancient old souks of the city, switches between anecdotes and architectural insights gleaned from research as she leads around the eclectic group of expats and Lebanese. Entering what would have been the Lebanese pavilion of the fair, a roof balanced on columns comprising three different levels, she points at the empty pools surrounding it and tells the group to imagine them full.
It's laying on water, okay? It's swimming on water. There are 33,000 square meters of reflective pools, okay? So many pools everywhere. One guy from Brasilia came once to my tour and he said to me something very interesting. He said, as if these buildings are looking at themselves in the mirror, you know? It's like these buildings are somehow narcissistic, you know? They are looking at the, and this is what he wanted exactly to happen. And so you arrive here, probably the exhibition is around. And then at this part also you can see the landscape, you can see the touristic hub, you can see the Grande Couverture, you can see the open air theater, the experimental theater, the helipad. Everything around you can be seen from here, okay?
Elsewhere in the site, she leads the group into one of Niemeyer's most intriguing designs, the experimental theater, a domed, spaceship-like creation sunk into the ground.
So the first thing we do is that instead of going inside the theater in a very normal horizontal way, we go down. So you see, we go down. We always have to go through these levels. You go down, probably they were like, this is like the reception here. And then you take the right.
The highlight for many people, at least in terms of photo opportunities, is the cathedral proportioned arch by the open air theater. A breathtaking white rainbow sat on a windy, elevated platform.
So look, if you go like I'm doing, backwards, and you look at the view, you know, like slowly you're discovering the space around you. It's amazing. You know, it's a whole, and this is what he wanted. He wanted to stimulate emotion. He wanted us to feel the space more than to look at it. And of course you have the majestic, grandiose arch, the gate to get in the theater.
The style of Niemeyer's architecture, in the International Fair here and elsewhere, is best summed up by a quote from the man himself, as written in his memoirs.
I am not attracted to straight angles or to the straight line, hard and inflexible, created by man. I am attracted to free-flowing, sensual curves, the curves that I find in the mountains of my country, in the sinuousness of its rivers, in the waves of the ocean, and on the body of the beloved.
In the East Beirut offices of the Arab Center for Architecture, founding member and university professor Georges Abid explains how the fair fits into Niemeyer's extensive body of work.
This piece by Niemeyer represents some sort of catalogue, if you want, of all the things he had experimented earlier. And it is also a premise to what he will be doing, he would be doing later in other places. It is definitely in continuity with his work, quite symptomatic of it, the freedom of the forms, the placement of all these buildings in the landscape that he has created.
Unfortunately, this modern masterpiece is located in Tripoli, a city that suffers from enormous unemployment and poverty, a city known within Lebanon as a hub for violence, extremism, and instability. As a result, attempts to give the fair a new lease of life have so far not been successful, despite the fact that the site's potential to provide economic stimulation is exactly what Tripoli needs. Arbid again.
So one has to be very creative nowadays, because since it was conceived, a lot of things have changed, and therefore perhaps Lebanon cannot anymore hope for an international fair to happen on its soil, because it requires much, much more than the country can offer in terms of services, transportation, housing, hotels, and all that goes with an international exhibition. Yet this place is a place that is awaiting some sort of creative idea on how to use it. Most importantly, I would say, for the benefit of Tripoli itself.
Next month, an enormous festival will be held there, a four-day extravaganza of musical, cultural and sporting events. It's a far cry from the international trade fair Niemeyer envisioned for the city, but at least the undulating concrete shapes will finally begin to get the exposure they deserve. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Tiffany & Co. is synonymous with its duck egg blue bags and tasteful jewellery, but another part of its august trade has been ticking over quietly since the mid-19th century. This year, the New York-based company is releasing two new watch collections, including the eye-catching new CT60 series. Monocle's Josh Fennett spent some time with Nicola Andreata, Vice President at Tiffany & Co. and General Manager of Tiffany Swiss Watches, to find out more about the collection and Tiffany's horological history.
This is a very exciting moment for Tiffany. We are launching two new watch collections, which for us are really important, just because it's a way for us to go back to our roots. You know, Tiffany has a huge history and a lot of heritage in the world of watchmaking nobody really knows about. just a few things. In 1847, we were already selling watches. 1874, we opened a factory in Geneva where we were manufacturing all our cases and our movements. We continued, and we have an extensive proof that we've been very active in watchmaking for so many years, that it was just about going back to our archives, find the right pieces, get inspired, and start to develop the new collections.
And I was very surprised to learn that maybe the American watchmaking industry at the time when Tiffany's was founded in the mid-19th century, that the American watchmaking industry was very big, but actually Tiffany chose to make its watches in Switzerland. Can you tell me a little bit about how that kind of New York Swiss connection has developed over the years and you know what it means to the collection?
Definitely. I mean, yes, you're right. In those years, the American watch industry was very developed. There were very important American brands producing, manufacturing watches and pocket watches specifically. And I like to think that the reason why Charles Louis Tiffany decided to go to Switzerland in 1874 was that he met with Alain Philippe in 1854, which was the beginning of our relationship with Patek Philippe, and a relationship which is ongoing today. I like to think that it was because of that that he thought, he understood that to make beautiful watches, he had to go to Switzerland. And you can imagine how difficult it could be at that time to sail to Switzerland, to go to Geneva, and to start a factory. So it's a beautiful partnership that started between Switzerland and USA at that time. And that's something we're trying to recreate today with our operations being established and founded in Switzerland again.
But if you'll forgive me, I feel like the CT60 collection, which I've seen, shows a little bit of kind of the American, identity of Tiffany, you know, taking back the kind of the Swiss manufacturing and making it more of a kind of equal partnership. I know that one of the watches from which the collection takes its inspiration is a very American watch. Maybe you could tell me about that.
Well, yes, you're right. We have more than 400 pieces in our archives today, watches and clocks. But there is one that we thought it was the quintessential American design for a watch, and that's a watch that was gifted to Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1945, a watch that he wore at the Yalta Conference. And we thought that, as I said, that's exactly what we feel the American design for a watch should be. A very open case, the subtle use of materials, but at the same time, the attention to details, a complication which is very useful, a yearly calendar, all that talks about America, all that talks about New York. And that's exactly what we tried to convey. It's a message. Tiffany has been in watchmaking since forever. We have our Swiss legacy. We went back to Switzerland, but we are an American brand based in New York, and that's something we need to tell everybody.
And more than a few Monocle readers and listeners know their onions and know a thing or two about watches, so maybe you, as an expert in the field, could tell us some of the specifics behind the mechanism and the materials used, just to kind of whet people's appetite for what they can expect.
Yeah, you know, as I said, we are trying to tell a story of craftsmanship, and at the same time, we want to reference our history. Tiffany and watchmaking, you know, the fact that we are, first of all, a jeweler, at the same time a watchmaker, means that we have a great attention to details. And beautiful watches, high-end watches, is just everything is details. So that's exactly what we did. We used only the best materials. We work with stainless steel and gold for these pieces. We work with the best suppliers. We have beautiful movements. The decision for this new collection, the CT60, was to start only with automatic movements. And so we have an yearly calendar for the CT60 calendar. We have an automatic chronograph for our chronograph, and we have a simple three ends automatic movement for the other two, the 40 millimeters and the 34 millimeters. We decided to open the case back with a sapphire glass to see exactly all the different finishings and the beautiful way of finishing the movements that we used. Just one example, the oscillating mass takes inspiration. The way we decorated the oscillating mass takes inspiration from the design of the handles of the flagship store in New York, with this radial Côte de Genève that we use to decorate the rotor.
That was Nicola Andreata, Vice President and General Manager at Tiffany & Co. Swiss Watches, talking to Monocle's Josh Fennett. After the break, we'll be taking a dip in the Hudson River, and I promise you, it's a lot more appealing than it sounds.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, at half an hour is now shorter, sweeter, new and improved. Where else can you end up informed and entertained after half an hour? By watching a quarter of Oscar-winning The Theory of Everything, by reading the first 20 pages of Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel, by speed-walking through a thousandth of the Venice Biennale, not on your Nelly. Culture with Robert Bound, smaller and even more perfectly formed.
This is what people do for a living, right? They put their shows on. This is the show of shows.
Culture premieres at 1900 hours London time on Mondays.
You're listening to Section D. Now that the sun's beginning to make an appearance for us up in the Northern Hemisphere, how about enjoying those rays, maybe poolside, while floating on the Hudson River? Well, you might be able to do exactly that, and rather sooner than you might have imagined. A Kickstarter initiative is successfully gathering the funds needed to construct a huge plus-sign-shaped swimming pool in the water between Manhattan and Brooklyn. Plus Pool will also use a cutting-edge filtration system that hopes to deal with the slightly off-putting provenance of much of that river's water. To find out when we can hope to get our trunks or bikinis on, Tom Morris spoke to the architects and Plus Pool partner Dongping Wong, who is on the line from our New York bureau.
So Plus Pool is an initiative by two design offices, Family and Playlab, both here in New York. Mm-hmm. And it's a project to build the world's first water filtering floating pool. So ostensibly it's an Olympic sized pool in the shape of a plus.
Why a plus? I'm so interested by that.
I think there's two reasons. One is quite frankly just because we thought it was funny looking. We wanted something that looked different. A plus shaped pool looks different. It's friendly in that way. Mm-hmm. And then the other side is actually as we started meeting with a lot of swimmers, we realized it kind of works perfectly because there's all these different types of people that want to use a pool, from competitive swimmers to kids to people that just want to hang out. So we kind of conceive it actually as four pools simply stuck together. Mm-hmm. So what's nice in that regard is that you can divide it into four different types of pools, but you can also open the whole thing up into basically an Olympic-sized pool just for play. I think that iconicity of it, the fact that it is simply just shaped differently and very recognizable, has actually been a big asset for the project.
And talk us through a little bit on the kind of eco side about how the water will be brought into the pool.
Sure. So at least to us, I think the most exciting part of it is that it's basically a giant strainer that you can drop into the river. So the walls of the pool, we're designing them to have a filtration system, basically layers of material that the water literally comes in from the river, goes through the walls of the pool, so to speak, and then enters the pool clean. So we've been actually testing this for about 3 years, first at Brooklyn Bridge Park and then the Hudson River in kind of real river conditions. And last time we tested was very exciting because we actually put every material in the water and actually arrived at water quality that's cleaner than kind of your typical pool water quality in the city here. And that was just sort of through the materials we're looking at and without any chemicals. So that was a huge encouragement. One of the things that, you know, we've been designing for but never actually gotten to see in kind of real condition, so hitting that mark was huge for us.
I mean, the pool is floating, but where will it actually be situated?
The pool will be sited in the rivers, obviously in New York, but we're actually looking at about 5 or 6 different sites right now, both on the Brooklyn side, up by Queens, down by Governor's Island, down Staten Island, on the Hudson River side. So actually all over New York, there's a lot of sites that are great for the project, but also very exciting in their own right in terms of what we think the pool can bring to a certain site and what a certain site can, I think, bring to the pool in that regard. Mm. What we've been talking about lately is because there's a lot of interest not only in New York for the project, but we've noticed and we've been speaking with a lot of cities around the world as well. We always say it's the site for the first plus pool. I think that the key here is that we really want this first project to catalyze, I mean, not only other plus pools, so to speak, but really other projects along the waterfront that are really connecting people back with the water in a different way, in a way that hasn't been done in a very long time. So The hope is that the first site is really the site for the first one, and then after that, who knows?
Because there's a huge kind of conversation around this at the moment. I know there's sort of plans to do this in London. There's been sort of, you know, making use of the waterways of Berlin and Paris for a long time now.
Yeah, I think we got lucky in a way with that there is this sort of global interest in that and kind of treating the city differently. And like you said, we were just part of an exhibition there in London with a few other projects looking to do very similar things. And I think it's exciting for us to sort of be a part of that globally anyway.
And what I think is most interesting about this one in particular is the part that design has to play in not only creating something iconic and recognizable with the plus, but also something that people want to sort of venture into and, yeah, will become a sort of part of the leisure landscape of New York and beyond.
Right. I think that's exactly, in a way, going back to the first question, you know, why the plus shape? We want people, I think, to simply like the project without having to be convinced of or buy into or sort of be morally responsible for the environmental side of the project. It's something that was simply, that looks like a great place to swim. I don't really care what it does. And that's actually very important for us. That there's actually very funny. One of our biggest supporters, he's been supporting us for probably 3 or 4 years now, actually. Only last year did he realize that it filtered water. And it was kind of funny because our first reaction was like, are you kidding me? Like, really, have you not been paying attention? But actually what was great is that he simply liked it, really just loved the project, just, you know, A, how it looked, the experience you could get, not the kind of underlayer of what we were trying to achieve on an environmental level. So I think the plus plays into that. I think bringing people back to the water is really just has to be more visceral in a way than responsibility-based, I guess.
Mm. And you're an architect by training, aren't you?
I am, yes.
This must have been probably one of the most fun projects an architect could take on, I imagine.
It is. It's also, I think, you know, us in PlayLab laugh a lot because when we started the project, both of our offices were just getting going. Mm. It was about a couple years after the recession, which meant as a young office, we were not getting a ton of work coming through the door. But this was always, this type of project was exactly the type of project we dreamed of doing. So I think that was a big reason why we just decided to start it. I mean, when we started it, we had no idea what starting a project like this meant. We had no experience with pools, let alone water filtration, let alone dealing with the scale of project with the city. So that's all been pretty incredible to pick up as we go along. But like you said, yes, this encapsulates, I think, almost everything of what we want to do in the office and what I want to do personally with architecture. But so in that sense, I mean, it's an ideal project.
And lastly, when is the hope that this will be realized? When will New Yorkers be swimming in the plus pool?
We always say we're still a few summers away. A big part of that is because even after we finish all design and engineering and it's ready to be built, there's a big zone of basically permitting and approvals, especially in a city like New York. And so we're budgeting just for that alone, you know, a good year and a half after all our work is done, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So I'd say best case scenario, 3 summers, and we're really kind of pushing fast for that. But again, because it's something that's so different and really hasn't been done anywhere before, we're making sure that the people that have to approve it and everybody's very happy with it, that we give everybody plenty of time to sort of, I guess, get socialized with it in a way.
That was architect Dongping Wong talking to Monocle's design editor Tom Morris about the proposed plus pool in New York. Now to end today's show, we're going to hear from the people behind Muller Van Severen, a Belgian-based artistic duo who've combined forces to create an innovative new range of furniture. They recently showed their collection here in London, and Section D producer David Pleasant went along to meet Fionn Muller and Hannes Van Severen to find out about their wares.
Before we worked with profiles that were painted or sometimes also just steel without paint, unpainted steel. But now we want to have a different finish or to make the profiles, the frames of our furniture. And we decided to make them rust, so it's a different finish.
I was interested when you talked about your background as visual artists and perhaps explain how that influences what you do. There is something very stark, very simple about the collection seen together. Are there references? Is it a modernist reference or something else? You know, what sort of influences are we talking about here?
I think we like to work with just existing materials, like existing profiles of steel. So it's easy for us to make a direct vision of a furniture in our studio. So we can weld it together and make very quick a prototype. And that's why we work with existing profiles and
a collage, let's say, we put things together, existing things together as a standard things together, and not like we don't want to have a new line or the new form. We want to make a new form with existing things. And in that way, it's like the same idea as before, as we work as individual artists. Like, when you ask me what's the difference, I don't feel it's a difference. For me, it's the same. For me, it's like we are doing the same, but now for me it's like more 3D dimensional. Before I was like more into 2D, and so I came out from the wall, let's say, but it's the same process actually as before. People can feel it, I think.
One major difference perhaps is the way you work with manufacturers and sourcing materials. Perhaps it has to be a very different way from being an artist to a designer. So we're not in your studio right now, we're not in your workshop, but maybe describe the scene, the working day. Is it very hands-on? Are you working with a team of other designers, manufacturers, producers, or is it your four hands on the pieces?
Yeah, we first start with a little drawing, a little idea, and then if we are happy with it, we go to our studio and we try to make it directly in 3D. So we start, we take some profiles and we start cutting them and welding them together, and then we have directly a good image of that piece and the proportion. And then if we are happy, we leave it like that and we bring it to a welder and we say, like, weld this, but good. And
does he ever say no? You're being stupid.
No, but we have to explain a lot, like the details. It's a really rough prototype we make, but he has to translate it into a very, very good thing.
Yeah, strong, yeah, sturdy, yeah, you know, yeah, all the kind of quality that you expect from a high-end piece of furniture. Finally, you've both come from Belgium today to be here in London to launch this new collection. Maybe tell us about where you're coming from. Does that influence your work? Is there a sort of ethic that perhaps we can see referenced in the work and the background to it?
Yeah. I lived for all my life in Ghent. It's a small town of 250,000 civilians. And Fien is from Exaarde. It's a town between Antwerp and Ghent. And we met each other on school. My father was also a designer, but he worked in a very strict way, like a minimalist. And Fien's family, she grew up in a Baroque environment.
Antiques, actually.
So I'm detecting something of the juxtaposition of, you know, the Belgian style as well. So you might get this sort of minimalist, modernist background, and then the Baroque,
like between our two families, I think, because I was living in a very colorful environment with a lot of
expressive,
yeah, I don't know, very expressive
colors and marbles.
So we can see that today. I mean, that you've chosen some very bright colors. We're standing by a tabletop. Maybe describe some of the materials here in this table. I mean, what is this? A lovely bright green number. I mean, one of these?
This is polyethylene. We used it a lot in our first pieces, but now we made them very solid, like in a thick sheet or plate, just one piece. And
yeah, before that we use it as a plate in a frame. So and now we show just the material on his own.
That was Fien Muller and Hannes van Severen talking to Monocle's David Pleasant. To find out more about their latest connection, head to mullervanseveren.be. That's all we have time for on this edition of Section D. The show was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact David at dmp@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show or have any comments or questions. It just remains for me to say thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.